Good evening, everybody. I'm Charles Berry. I'm the chairman of the board of the New York Society Library, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here this evening and to introduce the conversation on Adam Hirsch's Why Trilling Matters. I'm particularly excited about this subject because I had the pleasure and privilege of attending a series of lectures by Professor Trilling myself when I was at Cambridge in the early 1970s studying English. His lectures were a terrific breath of fresh air compared to some of the turgid monologues I was subjected to at the time. I'm also pleased to note a connection that makes tonight's subject one of happy significance for the New York Society Library. Lionel Trilling had a long association with our former board member, Jacques Barzan, who was for many years a member of our board and is still living at 104, I believe it is. Professors Trilling and Barzan were great proponents of Columbia's famous core curriculum, which always seemed to me to be a goal that we should all aspire to master as educated and literate people. We're fortunate to have with us both Adam Hirsch, the author of Why Trilling Matters, and Andrew DelBanco, the Director of American Studies at Columbia University, in what I know will be an engaging dialogue worthy of the memory of Professor Trilling. Mr. Hirsch is a senior editor of The New Republic and a columnist for Tablet Magazine. He's written several books of poetry and criticism and a recent biography of Benjamin Disraeli. His work on Trilling has been described as the best among any on his subject. Professor DelBanco is a highly accomplished teacher, writer, critic, and scholar. In addition to holding the Mendelssohn Family Chair of American Studies at Columbia, he's also the Julian Clarence Levi Professor in the Humanities. Among many other awards and fellowships, he received the 2011 National Humanities Medal bestowed on him by President Obama, and Columbia's Great Teacher Award, an honor that was also bestowed on Jacques Barzan. Professor DelBanco's book on Melville, a member of our library who took books out on whaling when he was writing Moby Dick, won, appropriately enough, the Lionel Trilling Award. Professor DelBanco writes regularly for the New York Review of Books, the New Republic, and other magazines and journals on a variety of subjects, including contemporary issues in higher education. Please welcome Andrew DelBanco and Adam Hirsch.
Well, thank you all very much for coming, and thanks for that introduction. And thank you to Professor DelBanco for coming to talk about Trilling with me today. And I hope we're also going to be talking about your new book, College, which is very close to Trilling's heart, and I think, as we'll see as we discuss, what college means and what Trilling means have a lot of things in common. I wrote Why Trilling Matters. Well, it's in a series of books about why things matter. So the title was sort of from the series. But I think it's a good title for Trilling because he's someone who I think used to matter a lot more than he does today, and I think he ought to matter more now than he does. And that was sort of one of my motives in writing the book. When Trilling died in 1975 at the age of 70, his obituary was on the front page of the New York Times. He was, for much of the mid-20th century, the leading literary critic and public intellectual of his generation. And he was something of a conscience, I think, to a lot of people. He represented the conscience, the superego, maybe, of literature. And one of the things I say in my book is that as someone who was a student of Freud, he was not uncritical of Freud, but he believed very strongly in Freud's greatness, Trilling wouldn't have been surprised that after his death the superego gets attacked and overthrown, because that's sort of your job, is to overthrow the superego. That's, I think, the state that Trilling's reputation is in now. After somewhat almost 40 years after his death, he's someone who's not at all forgotten. He's someone whose work is still in print, who's still written about regularly and invoked in contemporary debates, but often in a spirit of denigration or in a spirit that he's sort of antique or obsolescent, in particular because he was too serious, too solemn in the way he wrote about literature, maybe that he thought literature mattered too much. One of the things that I wanted to do in my book was first sort of offer an introduction to Trilling and an introduction to his work and his major ideas, but also to talk about him as an example of a life lived according to literature, a life engaged with literature in a very deep and profound way, and what it means to lead that kind of life at a time when literature, I think, is generally regarded as a marginal endeavor. It's no longer really as central to American culture as it was in Trilling's time. And there are lots of reasons for that, which maybe we'll discuss tonight. But going back to Trilling, for me, also means going back to a certain way of thinking about literature and why we read and why we write and why those things are important. So with that introduction, maybe we could talk a little bit about I wanted to ask Andy to talk a little bit about Trilling, who makes several appearances in your book, including one says Thrilling Trilling, which I like very much, not an adjective that's often applied to him, but apparently as a teacher at Columbia, he was considered thrilling.
Right. Well, I didn't know Trilling, though he meant a lot to me in my own youth. I did have the chance to get to know Diana, his widow, who was in some ways the curator of his reputation. And then when she wrote about him, she did a certain amount of damage to his reputation, I think. That was kind of an interesting contradiction. But I wanted to say, we didn't rehearse anything or make a plan for how this is going to go, and we're not here to engage in mutual congratulation. I'm not famous for flattery. It's not my most natural mode. But I want to say that Adam's book is really a very remarkable book. In a number of ways. Having just struggled to write a short book myself, I'm a real believer in whoever it was who said, I wrote a long book because I didn't have time to write a short book, meaning that a short book is really hard to write. And Adam has done that, and what's remarkable about it is that it operates on a number of different levels, and he's already, I think, indicated some of them. It's about Trilling as a, I'm not sure he'll go with this formulation, but Trilling as a kind of institution against which people have now rebelled or turned their backs, but who is a representative figure who really, you invoked his name if you wanted to sort of gesture at the significance of literature. But it's also about Trilling the man. It's not a biography full of incidental personal detail, but you get a sense of the conflictedness of Trilling from this book. And I firmly believe that all interesting writing is about people in conflict with themselves. So I just kind of wanted to say a couple of those things, and maybe we can go to whatever themes we want to, but to give a little bit of a sense of what I think Adam means when he shows us the conflictedness. This was a man who loved literature, lived literature, formed himself in response to literature, and yet at the same time, and this is a very powerful point in Adam's book, saw literature as in some ways dangerous. And you make the point, if I remember correctly, that he had a kind of sneaking sympathy with Plato's point of view that maybe if we put the writers in charge of the world or of even of educating us into the world, we might be opening ourselves to certain dangers. So I wondered if you would talk a little more about that.
Well, one of his most interesting essays, one of the essays that sort of gets to the heart of him, in particular as a teacher, is called On the Teaching of Modern Literature. And he starts out talking about his involvement in developing what I think is the core course on modern literature and ideas at Columbia, though it would be Lit Hum, right? Literature and Humanities.
Perhaps not, but it doesn't matter. It was a course on modern literature.
And he says that he was very resistant to there even being such a course. He didn't think that modern literature should be taught at all. And by modern, he meant from, say, T.S. Eliot onwards. He thought that those works were sort of, not because they weren't important, but on the contrary, because they were so important to him and to his generation personally, he didn't think that they could be reduced to classroom texts. And he says that the danger of teaching texts like that, he talks about Thomas Mann and André Gide, D.H. Lawrence, all of that sort of modernist canon is that they're so personal in the demands that they make on you as a reader. They ask you to sort of look at your own life and say, is my life an authentic one or is it inauthentic? Do I believe in the institutions of society or am I just going along with them? Do I want to be a bourgeois? D.H. Lawrence has a poem, How Beastly the Bourgeois Is. Or do I want to reject this way of life? He says in that essay that modern literature is like a howitzer and or a trireme, a Roman warship, and that you can't talk about those things without talking about the damage that they're meant to do, that these are works that are meant to do damage. And that once you start teaching them in a classroom, then they become items on a syllabus and the students know what the right answers to the questions are supposed to be. And as a result, they miss the sort of personal encounter with these works that Trilling felt was so valuable. And he talks about staring into the abyss. The students are asked to stare into the abyss, and then the abyss stares back at them and says, aren't I interesting? Aren't I deep? Don't I have so many interesting things in me? And he talks about the sort of absurdity of asking an exam question, talk about three modern writers and what they think about sex in contemporary society, meaning that these are supposed to be questions that you ask of yourself, and they're supposed to shape the way you live. They're not supposed to be things that you write a term paper about. Of course, he did go on to teach these things and teach them very well and influentially, but I noticed that there are things that he almost never wrote about, interestingly. Trilling's most famous essays are usually on 19th century English literature and seldom on modernist literature, even though those writers meant a great deal to him. It's as though he wanted to avoid academicizing them even in his writing.
Yeah, no, that's great. And one of the interesting moments in your book, you talk about, he wrote an essay about Howells. And I was thinking when Mr. Berry made the introduction and mentioned Melville, actually it was Howells' novel, A Modern Hazard of New Fortunes, that Melville took out of the New York Society Library to read, probably one of the last works of fiction he read near the end of his life. In any event, Adam writes about Trilling and Howells, and you describe this essay as sort of his struggle to want to love Howells, to want to take Howells seriously, but at the end he recognizes that Howells is finally, he's not a superficial writer, he's not a trivial writer, but he's not a writer who goes into the depths the way his contemporary Henry James did, for instance. And therefore, as a literary artist, he's unsatisfying, but as a sort of paragon of decency, the way one should live a life of control and reflection and self-awareness, he's a very good guide. So this is what I mean by the dividedness that one feels in Trilling and that comes through in Adam's book, that if you take literature seriously, or if you, the great question of modern literature, as Adam is just saying, or one great question is, where do I find authenticity? How do I bring myself to a level of intensity when I feel really alive? And the frightening thing in some of the great works of literary modernism is that to feel really alive, you become destructive, dangerous, violent. So he had a problem with the very literature that he insisted you couldn't live without.
And one of the things that sort of defines him and defined him as a figure is that he was always calling attention to the way that a educated readership, which then is now, he assumed, would be liberal. He said, you are all liberals, but the writers you admire are not liberals. The writers you admire are often fascists and reactionaries. He's thinking of people like Ezra Pound or D.H. Lawrence or people who are irrationalists, even Yeats at times. And he's saying, what is it? Maybe there's something to think about here, that your literary values are so different from our political values. Is there something lacking in our politics if we can't accommodate the things that we value in literature? He himself was someone who went through an intense radical sort of left revolutionary phase during the early years of the Depression, as many or maybe even almost all intellectuals of his generation did. And then after a fairly short time, started to move back towards the liberal center, you might say. And he sort of devoted his life to performing this mission, which was also the mission that Matthew Arnold performed in his day, and Trilling's first book was about Matthew Arnold, which was to say to the people who he was fundamentally in agreement with, we need to think more carefully about our ideas. We need to not assume that we're right so easily. This was another example, or maybe a main example in Trilling's work, of using literature to critique politics, to say literature has something important to bring to the way we think about politics.
Yeah. And I wonder if there isn't a clue in what Adam just said to the difficulty of retrieving Trilling for our own time. There was a very dispiriting conference at Columbia a couple of years ago that I actually was fortunate not to attend, but I think you were there.
Yeah, I did attend.
Right, and I think a graduate student from another institution, which I won't name, stood up and said, well, you know, none of us reads him. Why should we? And the people on the panel didn't really have an answer. They were sort of reading him because it was an assignment. So it was dispiriting. I heard about it afterwards from some people who were very upset by it. The question is why, and I wonder if one answer, there are a lot of answers, so I wonder one is that Trilling came of age at a time when the magnetic appeal of what we would call today the left, of radical ideas that had been instantiated in some way or other in the Soviet Union, and for a while a lot of intellectuals here and elsewhere thought that that was really a model for how the world should be reconstructed, that Trilling came of age at a time when that was the live issue. And he flirted with it, maybe embraced it, wanted to believe in it himself. And much of his career can be understood as a sort of self-critique about the reasons he had been drawn to these ideas and the horrific consequences, in fact, that flowed from those ideas. It seems to me that to get today's young people excited about that struggle is not easy. One reason for that is because we don't have a significant left anymore. There's a famous, everybody quotes it, famous sentence in the preface or introduction to The Liberal Imagination where Trilling says, in America there are no conservative ideas. There are only irritable gestures that are sort of masquerading or pretending to be ideas. Well, it may still be true that there are no conservative ideas, but there's a kind of conservative consensus almost that didn't exist then. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the shifting political landscape makes it hard to get him back.
Yeah, that is one of the big barriers, and it's one of the reasons why in writing about Trilling, I tried to sort of deliberately de-emphasize his politics, his political side, and emphasize more his literary side, or think about him as a literary figure, because it's true that as a political figure, he belongs to a moment that is gone, that it's no longer true that there's this totalitarian temptation, which is really what he was writing about, the temptation for people who thought of themselves as liberals to say that communism is sort of the end point of liberalism, or it's liberalism in a hurry, and therefore a liberal has to be essentially sympathetic with communism. I think that idea is not completely gone. There are still places where it lingers on, but because there is no real communism anymore, it's a very academic issue. It's not a live issue anymore. He left behind one of the great documents of that in his one novel, The Middle of the Journey. Trilling was very disappointed that he did not become a great novelist. That's really what he wanted to do at the beginning of his life. He wanted to be a novelist, and he only published the one novel. But it is a good novel, and it's something that's still very much worth reading. It was published in 1947, and it's very interesting as a snapshot of what it was like to be in the liberal intelligentsia in the 30s and 40s. And he draws on his own experience, and in particular, there's a character in the novel named Gifford Maxim, who's based directly on Whittaker Chambers and who Trilling knew and was at Columbia with as an undergraduate. Whittaker Chambers, of course, was someone who was demonized by the left, who was considered a liar and was trying to smear Alger Hiss. And Trilling sort of believed in Chambers to the dismay of a lot of other people. And he once famously wrote that Chambers was a man of honor, something that was not common opinion among his circle at all. what he's writing about in this book is why a right-thinking liberal couple, the Croomes, would agree to act as a clandestine mail drop for communist espionage. And the reason that he's getting at is that he sees this liberal embrace of communism or moral blindness about communism to get at the heart of what's missing from liberalism as a set of ideas. And what's missing is moral complexity. What's missing is what he calls moral realism, which is the idea that good acts can have bad consequences or that good ideas carried to an extreme can turn into bad ideas. And for him, that's a lesson that literature teaches best of all, and in particular the novel teaches best of all, which is one reason why he liked Henry James so much. One of his most famous essays is about The Princess Casamassima, which is James's most political novel, and he talks about how James's imagination of disaster, his sort of recognition that politics can lead to disaster and catastrophe, is something that made him a prophetic writer, writing in the 1880s about things that wouldn't become clear until the 1930s.
Right, and I think Adam made a good choice to not center his book on Trilling's significance in the political landscape of his time. But as I mentioned, Adam, I think in another context, I had the pleasure of teaching a course with a person who was probably Trilling's closest student and really protege, Stephen Marcus, and we taught The Princess Casamassima in that course, and it was in the late 90s, and we had a very hard time to get the students to engage with it. This is a book about an anarchist cell in which there is a kind of suicide bomber as the climax of the plot. And it seemed a very distant subject. It seemed something, you know, that you looked up in the library, that there used to be people like this in the world. And then, of course, something that we now call 9/11 happened after our course was over. And I've often thought what it would be like to teach, I haven't done it since, teach that book in the wake of 9/11. I think it would be alive in another way, and I think Trilling's essay would be alive in another way. So I think the context does matter. I wanted to say one thing that, and it's perfectly reasonable that it's not in Adam's book, but I have a sense, and I'm just guessing, because, you know, I got to Columbia 10 years after Trilling died, and he was still very much the presence, kind of the ghost of Hamilton Hall, and Diana still lived in her first floor apartment on Claremont Avenue. They always lived on the first floor because she had claustrophobia and wouldn't go in an elevator. Mm. And people would come regularly to see her, to pay homage to the memory of the great man. But I didn't know him, and so the only way in which I feel I know him, the most important way, is through his writing. But then I know a lot of people who did know him, including the person who's told me the students called him Trilling. But I have the sense that he had a very good sense of humor. Mm. And as you said, he's often faulted for being too solemn a writer. One of the things that people complained about like crazy, especially in the 80s and the 90s, was his use of the plural pronoun we, which seemed to be, it wasn't the royal we, it wasn't the editorial we, it was sort of, Who am I speaking for, we? People took him to task for that, and we could talk about that a little bit. But in any event, the sense of him as a very solemn person seems a little bit off to me. And I'll give two examples of why I think that, and then I'd be interested in your response. One is just an anecdote that I heard from a former colleague of his, a wonderful story, to my ear at least, of a class he's teaching on King Lear. And maybe this story has made the rounds. And a student makes a comment in the course of the discussion and says something about, well, to me, Lear represents this or Lear represents that. And Trilling cuts him off and says, King Lear to you. Right. So that story kind of helps me imagine what it would have been like to be in the classroom with him. And the other evidence I would cite for this, it's an essay not often discussed. It, Leon Wieseltier includes it in his selection of the essays, and that's his essay about the Kinsey Report, which to my mind, I actually reread it this morning in preparation for tonight, to my mind is a hysterically funny essay. You know, this is this big thing that comes out in the 50s, and it's the first time, you know, sexual behavior is discussed very candidly, very matter-of-factly, and very numerically. Right. So at one point in that essay, Trilling says, and we've been introduced to a new figure who is the scholarly and skilled lawyer who for 30 years has been experiencing 30 orgasms per week. Right. And Trilling says, now, the point of the essay is you can count it. So there it is. It's real. And that the premise behind the Kinsey Report is sort of the more orgasms, the better. And that's the more, and it's more natural. The more you have, the more, the closer you are to nature. And he said it never seems to occur to the authors of this report that maybe there's a pathology here on the part of this lawyer desperately seeking his 29th and 30th orgasm of the week. So it occurred to me when I was thinking about this, it would be interesting to read Trilling's review, for instance, of this very shocking and disturbing recent film called Shame, which is about sexual addiction, and which presents, you know, the successful sexual performance as a disease and pathology of the individual and of the culture, rather than as a thing devoutly to be wished for. So anyway, I just think he's can be witty and funny, and I wonder if you feel that too.
Well, I think that He is a solemn writer a lot of the time. So I don't, maybe solemn is not a good word because it has slightly maybe pejorative connotation. But he's very serious. He doesn't crack a lot of jokes on the page, right. Although maybe he did in life. And he, you hear different things about him as a teacher depending on who you ask. He was, for example, he hated, hated teaching graduate students, and he was very glad when he got exempted from having to supervise dissertations. He was very, he held academia at arm's length in a certain way, even though he was very much a part of it and spent his entire life almost at Columbia from undergraduate until retirement. But I think that the sort of seriousness is appealing, at least to me, because, and I talk a little bit about the we in the book, because he does use we a lot. And I think that the we is really more an invitation. It's really more a way of saying, what do we think about this book? What is our reaction to it, and what can we learn from our reaction to it? I don't think it's supposed to be, he's pronouncing from on high, we are not amused, that kind of thing. A good example is another one of his most famous essays is about Mansfield Park, the Jane Austen novel. And he starts out by saying, no one likes Fanny Price, the heroine of Mansfield Park. And why is it that no one likes her? Why is it this the one Jane Austen novel that virtually no one is enthusiastic about? And he goes on from there to say, you know, it's because we no longer understand this idea of goodness as resignation, as meekness. We can only sympathize with the idea of goodness as opposition and energy. And that this is a whole way of thinking and feeling that's sort of lost. And that's a good example, I think, of the way that the we is really a way of scrutinizing a consensus view. He wants to say, what is it that we think about literature? What is it that we think about this book? That, to him, is often as interesting as the book itself. And it's interesting that he, although he is a literary critic, or that's the best way to categorize him, he doesn't do a lot of the things that critics do. I mean, he didn't review a lot of new books. He doesn't explain the way a book works most of the time. He doesn't do close readings or anything like that. What he really does is he writes about what it feels like to read a book. He says, if I read Jane Austen, why do I like Emma and not like Fanny Price? If I read Keats, why does Keats seem like such an exceptionally positive figure? Why does he has an essay called The Poet as Hero. Why does Keats seem like a hero? Or with Howells, why does Howells, despite his desire to like Howells, still seem like sort of a shallow writer and not a first-rate writer? That is always, or is often, his starting off point will be the reception or the feeling, what he thinks the feeling about a book or a writer is. So in that sense, I think it's more of an invitation rather than laying down the law from on high. The Kinsey Report essay is one of his most interesting essays because it presents him in a light that you don't often think of him in, but also because that idea that it's sort of American to want to measure everything is something that he rails against in other contexts as well. In particular, he has an essay in which he talks about why at his time, and you can even see this today in certain people, liberal literary critics, left literary critics, don't like Henry James and do like Theodore Dreiser. And he talks about how it's a certain idea of massiveness, that reality is something hard and resistant and massive, and it's never something light and delicate. He says, we always think of reality as being like as being powerful like an elephant, and never as being powerful like electricity. That, I think, is might be a lead into college and the idea of college that in your book about college, which I think has just been published, right?
Tomorrow
is publication day. You talk about the history of college, the history of specifically not just higher education, but about college as an experience from Puritan times to the present, but also the sort of pressures facing the college experience today. And one of them is the desire to make it productive, right, to make it count in ways that can be measured. And that is, as you see it, as a threat to the college experience, what it should be about.
Right. Well, I appreciate the elegant segue, but we don't need to leave Trilling behind and just now talk about college. I think we can talk about the two together, and they go together quite naturally because, as Adam has said, he spent his whole career at Columbia, and he very much identified, that's a formulation he wouldn't like, he very much thought of himself as most closely associated with the college and not with the larger enterprise called the universities. In fact, I play a game with my graduate students sometimes, and I say, okay, now I'm going to name some figures from the English department, from the past of the Columbia English department, and I name some very estimable scholars like William York Tyndall and John Unterrecker and Marjorie Hope Nicholson. I mean, these were all fine people, and I don't mean to denigrate them at all. And I say, have any of you heard of them? And they haven't. They look completely blank, which is very encouraging to those of us who are thinking about retirement, and you realize about 30 seconds after you're gone, they'll clean out your office, and that'll be the end of you. Anyway, but then I say, well, what about Mark Van Doren, Frederick Dupuy, and Lionel Trilling? And they say, well, yeah, you know, I've heard of them, and maybe even one or two has read something by them. And then I said, now, is it interesting to you to realize that those three figures were all members of the college faculty, and they were all in Hamilton? Well, those of you who know the Columbia campus, there's a couple of Columbians in the back here, know that Hamilton Hall is the headquarters of the college, and then the English department now is in Philosophy Hall, which is where the graduate studies are centered. So these guys thought of themselves as living in Hamilton Hall, and they really thought of college students as the reason they got up in the morning to go teach. Some of them also taught graduate students, and graduate students should also not be denigrated, because what we hope from graduate students is that they will someday become very good college teachers, and I think that's the main reason to teach them. But the larger point, I'm rambling a little here, my apologies, but I think Trilling thought of the curious, intelligent undergraduate student who hadn't necessarily read any of the books that were on the syllabus as his best interlocutor. And that was the same audience for which he wrote. I mean, maybe his readers tended to be a little older and a little bit better read, but there was no disjunction between his life as a public intellectual, to use a phrase that everybody throws around today, and his life as a scholar, which he was, wrote a dissertation with footnotes and everything, and teacher. And so part of what I try to get at in my book is that we've lost that sense of the college as the central activity of the university, and as an activity every bit as challenging, significant, difficult as the research activities of the research side of the university. So I think Trilling would be a little disheartened by the condition of the academic literary studies today. I would also, I have to say, though, that Trilling furnishes a very good example of how the lamentations that we engage in today, and I'm big on lamentation, are not new. So, in fact, he has an essay, it's on the uncertain future of the humanistic educational ideal, or some somewhat clunky title like that, where he says he went to a meeting of the Columbia College faculty in 1964 and felt the energy had gone out of the room, that people were kind of checking their watches. They didn't have, you know, BlackBerries and cell phones in those days, but they were checking their watches. They wanted to get it over with so they could go back to their offices and resume the work on whatever project they were working on, that they were not interested in the collective enterprise of working together as colleagues for the education of undergraduate students. Now, that was almost 50 years ago. It's gotten a lot worse, I'm afraid. I came from a very dispiriting faculty meeting today where there wasn't a single mention of any issue concerning undergraduate education. But it was already happening, to his mind, in the 60s. And he's given to a little bit of golden ageism, I think, that, you know, the era that he went to college was when it was everything was good, which I think we're all given to that to some extent. But it is troubling that that the energy that he represents so well of literary academic study seems not to be with us so much anymore.
Well, thinking of numbers, I think one of the figures or the statistics that you quote is that there's something like 4 million people enrolled in various kinds of colleges, and 100,000 of them are in liberal arts colleges.
Right. This was I dislike statistics, but every once in a while I'll use one to my own advantage if I can. It was pointed out that the number of undergraduate students who attend an independent liberal arts college in this country, now that's not quite the same thing as a place like Columbia College, which exists within a university, but a freestanding liberal arts college like Amherst or Swarthmore or Oberlin or Pomona or something like that, You could take all those students and fit them into one Big Ten football stadium, right? So the number of students who are getting the sort of purest college experience, that with the residential four-year, get learning from your peers, having time with your professors who are mostly focused on you and not so focused on their professional activities, that's a very, very small portion of the overall undergraduate population today. It's a struggle to keep that ideal of college education alive.
Well, it connects up with, and even the figure connects up with something that I talk about in the beginning of the book, which is numbers versus influence, that Trilling is thought of today as someone who had a very large public influence, public presence, but he was writing for magazines like Partisan Review that reached maybe 6,000 people, versus someone like Jonathan Franzen, who sells millions of copies but still feels that literature is somehow doesn't have the influence, is marginal to the culture in a way that he doesn't want it to be, but sort of acknowledges that it is. And why it is that you could have that confidence 50 or 75 years ago and you don't have it today, why it's so hard to have it today. It's a hard question to answer. I don't know if I have the answer. I mean, there's technological, there's sociological and economic reasons, but part of it might just be a crisis of confidence, which is something that maybe could be addressed by will and resolve.
Well, there are so many ways to go. I mean, you know, one, I think it's demonstrably untrue that there aren't any figures anymore like Trilling, because one of them is sitting right here. How you would measure Adam's influence as a young critic against that of the young Edmund Wilson or the young Lionel Trilling, I'm not sure.
I'm blushing.
Well, I'm not sure how you would do that, but it would probably be a silly experiment. But that even very accomplished critics like Adam, who writes in all the main venues of serious literary writing, I don't mean to put words in your mouth again, but you probably don't feel quite as central to the conversation as those guys did. And you'd probably be right. It's hard to, there are so many reasons. I mean, just the very, you might call the technology of the college, by which I don't mean the machinery, but the procedures by which teaching happens, lecture and small class discussion. We are now living in a moment where students are bombarded with so many sensory impressions at every moment of the day and night, and they come in with two and three different electronic devices, and the whole idea of sitting still, the Columbia class period, which was a shock to me when I came here from another place where the classes were shorter, is an hour and 15 minutes. And to expect a 19 or 20 year old to really stay totally focused on what one person is saying for 75 minutes turns out to be a significant challenge. I think it can still be done, and I like to believe actually that it's becoming so weird and so different from everything else that they experience that it's taking on a certain kind of appeal as a curiosity. But Trilling wasn't dealing with that, right? And the decorum of the institution was at a certain level that it isn't anymore. And then the struggle, I mean, he says in a very almost elliptical way, there's a certain special value in the small discussion. Well, every institution of higher learning, even the wealthiest ones, is struggling today to sustain the model of the small class discussion simply because it's so expensive, right? You put one reasonably well-paid faculty member at the front of the room and you have 15 students in the room. That ratio is expensive from the point of view of the budget guys in the main office. It's much better to have the students all sitting in their dorm rooms downloading a lecture for that you've licensed or rented from some other institution. And then I think we won't be long before we get to the point where their papers and exams will be graded by somebody in another country, just like when you call up to complain about your cable service, you're talking to somebody in another country. So there are a lot of pressures that are eating away at the college experience that Trilling exemplified, loved, and meant so much to. And my little book is an effort to say, hey, let's not let this disappear without knowing what we're losing. Let's fight for it. Let's have a reasonable discussion about why it's important to us as a society. Well, I'd actually like to see a little more searching myself. I take your point. And there are a lot of reasons. I mean, the dispiriting thing to me, I mean, you can understand that, I mean, one of the great success stories of our society, and I think Trilling would have generally approved of it, is the enormous expansion of the numbers of college students that we have in relation to what it would have been, let's say, when he was in college, or in the early 20th century when only 2 or 3% of the college age population was in college. Now it's a kind of expectation, and Senator Santorum got upset with the president because the president said everybody should get some post-high school education, and Santorum turned that into a rallying cry for his constituency. Anyway, now it's an assumption that everybody who possibly can should go to college, and a lot of these students, of course, are first-generation college goers. A lot of them come from families without much affluence, although I think we're not doing as good a job as we should at keeping the college opportunity open to such families. So it's, you can understand that students from those circumstances want to know, okay, I'm going into debt, my parents are spending a lot of money on this, I need to know what's at the other side of it. I need to know what form of gainful employment I'm going to have a better chance to get as a result of this investment than otherwise. So we could sort of put that aside. But what's really dispiriting to me is that in the kinds of institutions where Trilling taught, the Ivies, the very wealthy elite universities, as they tend to be described, the students are leaving the humanities in significant numbers in those institutions too. When the current president of Harvard took office, she challenged the senior class at her first commencement and said, how come 60%, well, it was 60% of the men and 40% of the women, so I guess that averages out to 50. How come 50% of you are going into what's euphemistically known as financial services? You know, I mean, why aren't you either taking some time to figure out who you are and what how you want to construct your life, which is what Drilling's work is all about, or turning the privileges that you've had into an opportunity to do something beneficial for other people? It's not that good people can't go into finance, and a lot of people who are successful in finance turn out to be very generous in their later lives. But it's odd that there's this stampede to just sort of feeding the self with as many material possessions as you can cram in. So I think he would have been very disturbed by this, and I think those students who took his courses probably would have thought twice about going in that direction.
So one of the things I've always wondered is, why did Trilling stay at Columbia, particularly at the beginning of his career, when there was a significant antagonism from the top toward him?
Well, you're alluding, I take it, to this is a story that Diana tells in her memoir. Lionel Trilling was the first Jew tenured in the Columbia English Department, and arguably the first Jewish critic scholar in a very high visibility department. And there's no doubt that English departments in those days, especially, were characterized by a certain genteel or maybe not so genteel anti-Semitism. So there were some rough times, but the story she tells is actually very charming and is one of the most favorable stories I've ever heard about Nicholas Murray Butler, who was president of Columbia for the first half of the 20th century, was that he, although he was a pretty stiff character himself and probably had some unattractive attitudes toward people, was very much impressed with this young instructor in the English department because he read his book about Matthew Arnold, which, can you imagine the president of the university reading such a book today? I can't. And so she tells this charming story about how there was some gathering and Butler comes up to you, yeah, Mr. Trilling, I want to congratulate you on your English reviews. And in those days, you know, you didn't get reviews online. You waited till somebody sent them to you in the mail. So Trilling didn't know what he was talking about. But Butler had been following his career and watching the reception of this book in London. And then he invited the whole English department to his house. And Diana gets this invitation saying, we're invited to the president's house. And she's very worried. She doesn't know what to wear. So she calls the fashion editor, right, of one of the newspapers, I can't remember which, and says, I'm invited to a very formal occasion, and should I be wearing long white gloves? And the answer was, well, no, just don't be silly. There's no place in New York where ladies wear long white gloves anymore, unless it could be the house of the president of Columbia University. So she puts on the long white gloves, and they go to this party, and then, and believe it or not, you know, after dinner, the gentlemen go to the cigars, and the ladies go to the other room, and the president comes in with the chairman of the English department and the other honchos and gives a little speech about how he recently was speaking to the German ambassador or something and said, you know, here in the United States, we make no distinction between Christians and Jews. We just look at the quality of their work. And he looks, you know, tellingly at the chair of the English department, and apparently the next week, Trilling got tenure. So, you know, he wanted to stick it out. It was his, he liked it. He liked the students. You can't imagine leaving New York. Where's he going to go? So he didn't feel like getting driven out of the place, and eventually he made it over in his own image, at least for a while.
Yeah.
suggested that the liberal arts curriculum in the university be abandoned for one generation. The argument ran as follows. Children come to the university today, and they register, and they get the student activity card and the map of the campus and the university health booklet, and just about as automatically, they get a packet of cultural and political attitudes. That these attitudes are negative or sinful didn't seem to be what worried Trilling. It was more that they are dispensed and accepted with such an air of conformity and inevitability. The student emerges from the university with a set of ready-made, intact, untouched by direct experience. What was the solution? Well, why not turn off the packaging apparatus for a while? In time, they might develop a generation of intelligent people who had experienced American life directly and earned their opinion.
Well, Adam should speak to that because I think it goes to his point about Trilling's concern of the sort of the domestication of literature. But I would just quickly say he may get his wish in the sense that, you know, one hopes it's cyclical. Now the students are fleeing from the humanities. Maybe they'll in 10 years they'll turn around and say, hey, you know, let's give this weird thing a try. Nobody's in it. Maybe it's worth a shot, and it'll have a certain freshness and novelty again. Who knows? But...
Well, I'm not familiar with that speech, but he has an essay called The Two Environments, I think it's called, in which he talks about how it used to be the case that a student would come from a sort of mainstream bourgeois upbringing and come into contact with advanced thought and rebel against their upbringing, but that there was developing a sort of counterculture, and he was writing this, I think, in the mid-60s, and that you would assimilate into the counterculture so completely that literature was no longer a challenge to you because you were no longer part of the first environment. You were only part of the second environment, and that diminished the sort of power and value of the education that you were supposed to be getting. He talks about how he has the sneaking... admiration for the very rare students of his who are disgusted by the books that he has them read because he sort of thinks that there should at least be some people who are able to react to these ideas strongly enough to be disgusted by them rather than say, you know, I've seen it all and nothing makes an impression.
I think maybe we have time for one more. Yeah.
Well, he was actually one of the three, I think, people who led the committee after the student strike to investigate what had happened. And Diana Trilling tells a story in her autobiography that during the strike in 1968 with the occupation of Hamilton Hall, that someone put up a poster saying wanted Lionel Trilling for crimes against humanity, that because he was so identified with the establishment of the university. There's a sort of debate about Trilling's legacy. This is less argued about than it was in the 70s and 80s, but there were people among the neoconservative camp who thought of Trilling as an inspiration, in particular Norman Podhoretz, who was his student, one of his best students, and has written about this in several of his books, felt that Trilling was being evasive in not sort of owning up to his neoconservatism, in not sort of coming out and embracing that movement. And then Diana Trilling argues against that and says that that's not the right way to understand him. I think that, as in a dialectical way, which Trilling would appreciate, that there's truth on both sides of that. There are people, one of them is Gertrude Himmelfarb, who take great inspiration from Trilling as a conservative cultural critic of the post-60s culture, and there are definitely things in Trilling's work that can lead to that. At the same time, I think that he was very careful not to become trapped in political debates. He was essentially a literary figure, not a political figure, and he didn't want to be involved in the debates of the day. He wanted to write really more about his own experience as reflected through texts.
Yeah, I actually don't know much about that moment. I should find out about it. But I would say that, you know, there was no good side to be on. And I think he felt that. That, you know, he saw the destructive energies that the students were tapping into and unleashing that made a damaged the university very significantly for a very long time, and we're still, in certain ways, recovering from it, from the faculty flight and the alienation of donors and so on and so forth. But the administration of the university at that time was recalcitrant and insensitive and couldn't begin to understand what these young people were upset about. And I think that was not true of Trilling. I mean, you know, Adam writes about this wonderful story he writes, which is this eerie prediction of the character of Allen Ginsberg. He writes, which is tremendously sympathetic to a student who's, you know, kind of before the fact representation of the student rebels of the 60s. So I expect that he was torn as he and divided, to get back to where we started this conversation about that situation. And I expect it took a lot out of him. I know he was, I do remember his comment about Archibald Cox was brought down from Harvard to do a study of what had gone wrong at Columbia, and he criticized the administration very severely, which was probably merited, and then he praised the students for being the most idealistic and most thoughtful and students in all of modern history, and Trilling took great exception to that and thought that that was not the case. So he was, I think he wasn't quite sure what he felt and thought about it all, and that's not an indictment of him. I think it was hard for thoughtful people to know what to think. One more? Yeah.
Yes, another early professor at Columbia who was Jewish was Meyer Shapiro, and I wondered, I happened to have been a student of Shapiro. He never mentioned Trilling, and I just wondered if you could let us know what their relationship was.
I actually don't know the answer to that. I know that they were undergraduates at the same time. They were part of this cohort that included Chambers, but I don't know in particular what their relationship was like.
I don't either. I mean, I wouldn't be a man, and this is totally reckless and irresponsible speculation. I mean, I heard a story on pretty good authority once about the young Meyer Shapiro going to visit Bernard Berenson, and when they were alone, he said, "Listen, why don't you know?" He started speaking Yiddish to him, and Berenson was very upset and threw him out of the house, right? And so I wouldn't be amazed if there was a certain tension there, because Trilling did have this sort of regal. I mean, Adam writes, I shouldn't have brought this up because this is very complicated stuff. He writes very sensitively about Trilling's relation to his Jewishness and knocks down the straw man idea that Trilling was somehow ashamed of being Jewish or was not interested in his Jewish identity. It's much more complicated than that. But still, I wonder, I have a feeling that he and Shapiro were sort of temperamentally sufficiently different that they might not have been the closest of friends. Okay. Shall we let that end of sentence be the end
of
the...
I think so.
Okay. Listen, thank you all very much for coming.
Yes, thank you for coming.